Well, this is going to be really fun because what I'm going to give you this morning, this is my mixtape of Ken Sandy's greatest hits. I mean, if you wanted to sort of collect in one place some of the wisest sort of gleanings and sayings of more than 4 decades of peacemaking from Ken Sandy, I'm gonna give it my best shot. And you might ask, well, what qualifies me to produce a mixtape of Sandy's greatest hits? Well, in the hardest season of my life, over a period of about 4 years, for 4 years, there was hardly a day passed that I did not receive a phone call or a text message from Ken Sandy. And I know to some of you that sounds unbelievable. It still is to me. But I tell you that because Ken asked me to speak this morning on what he has uniquely equipped me to do, and that's share how the principles of relational wisdom translate into our everyday relationships. Okay? But here's the headline. Years ago, Ken shared with me that in almost 40 years of Christian conciliation, in every conceivable context, around the world and across the country, that he had witnessed scenes of reconciliation and forgiveness in every context. I mean, from genocide in Rwanda to cases of the most profound personal betrayal, marital infidelity, physical and domestic abuse. Again and again, Ken said he had witnessed firsthand the power of the gospel. In every place you could imagine, except one. There was one outlier. There was one place that was seemingly immune to God's healing touch. And that was conflict among church leaders, among pastors and leadership boards in particular. That is the one place, Ken said, that biblical peacemaking had proven to have very little effect. Now, maybe your experience has been different, but perhaps you've asked, why is it that the people who ought to have the most resources for navigating conflict, why are we often the worst at handling it in our churches? Well, I'm going to take up that question in detail on Sunday morning, but today I want to take up what I believe is a primary underlying cause. And that's that despite the resources we've been given in the gospel, and despite our best intentions, many of us don't know how to navigate everyday conflict. We have it every day, but we don't know how to navigate it, everyday conflict. And here's the thing, we don't know that we don't know. We think we know because we know so many of the right words. And these words are precious and important to us. And because they're so precious, we think we understand what they mean, not realizing how much pain and work and time it will take for these words to become more than words, but living ways of how we interact with one another with mercy and compassion. I mean, I don't know about you, but I've seen the most mature believers just come unglued by a small drop of suffering. Don Carson once said that the time to develop a theology of suffering is before you need it. He said, because if you wait until you're in it to try and construct it, it's too late. I'd like to suggest it's the same with peacemaking. If you wait till you need it to try and practice it, it's often too late. The lines are too entrenched. Just a drop of conflict can split mature men and women who love Jesus. And it leaves us all wondering, how did this happen? How did we get here? And I'm suggesting it's because we never realized that we'd never been equipped to navigate everyday conflict. See, the words are simple, but the practice of mercy, the practice of compassion, rare. Managing everyday conflict is not at all intuitive. The language of Jesus, to use the language of the Bible, is not of this world. takes a lot of practice, a lot of training. It is against the grain of our worldly natures. We have to realize, I may know a lot of doctrine, but when it comes to how to handle conflict, I need help. We can be theologically educated, but conflicts take us into a realm that is foreign to us, and that is the realm of our emotions. And when our theological IQ is greater than our EQ, our emotional intelligence, as mine, certainly my story, we can get mired and not know why we're stuck. I've come to believe that a main reason we get stuck is what we're talking about, our inability to work through conflict. We more often avoid it, not realizing that working through conflict, this is precisely the path to building deep trust with one another. So today, torn from the pages of my own experience and literally hundreds of hours with Ken Sandy, I'm going to give you five phrases that I've learned. Now, these are not five steps. These are not five things to remember when conflict arises. Because when conflict arises, we often react rather than respond. One author put it, when it matters most, we're often at our worst. So I'm giving you my wife uses the metaphor of sailing at sea. She says, we must practice the emergency drills when the sun is out and the water is calm, so that when the storm strikes, we can know which ropes to pull. I like that metaphor. You can think of these five phrases as ropes in the storm. We're practicing in the sun, so when the storms come, we'll know how to pull one or two of them. Now, for each, more could be said, and some of these need nuancing, but I'm suggesting if we could internalize even one of these phrases, they're all very simple, but if we could internalize even one, much less all five, it would revolutionize how we go through our daily conflicts. Each one is deceptively simple. The first three have to do with our posture before we ever open our mouths. Because in healthy relationships, how you present yourself, your posture, matters just as much as your position. That is what you think you're talking about. Okay? So the first three have completely to do with our posture before we ever open our mouths. And the first is, you know, Ken loves acronyms. Well, the first is an acronym, WAIT. WAIT. When you're about to have what one writer called a crucial conversation defined as high stakes, strong emotions, and conflicting positions, before you open your mouth, WAIT stands for Why Am I Talking? It's shocking how many times in the Bible our sin is attached to our words. Now, there are dozens of proverbs on the wisdom of choosing to keep our mouths shut. Here's one. Even a fool who keeps silent is considered wise. James counsels us to be slow to speak, quick to listen. In conflicts, words are like bullets, and you can't unshoot the gun. Once spoken, words can be taken back, but they won't be forgotten. How many of our conflicts could have been avoided just had we not spoken? Proverbs 19:11 reads, "It is one's glory to overlook an offense." Now, to be sure, there's a time to speak, Ecclesiastes 3. Speaking up in the face of injustice is an act of courage on behalf of others, as Martin Luther King Jr. taught us. But what we're talking about today is in everyday conflict, wait, why am I talking? One of the resources that's really helped me is the book Difficult Conversations. It's a perennial bestseller on navigating everyday conflict. And the book is built on the premise that in every difficult conversation, there are actually three conversations. I mean, this one little nugget is worth the whole book. But the authors say, in every conversation, there's actually three conversations. on the surface, they say is the what happened conversation. And that's where we spend most of our time arguing, making our case, asking for examples, defending our positions. Most conflicts stay here and stall out because, as the authors put it, we often fail to question one crucial assumption on which our whole stance in this conversation is built. I am right. You are wrong. And they say this simple assumption causes endless grief. What's fascinating is the book argues that where we spend most of our time, the what happened conversation, that is a dead-end street. They said instead we need to pay attention to the conversation that's going on beneath the surface, the conversation that's really driving the conversation, what they call the feelings conversation, and underneath that, the identity conversation. But this morning I just want to talk about the feelings conversation and the importance of our emotions. Difficult conversations, they write, don't just involve our feelings. They are at their very core about feelings. I think this is news to most of us in our hyper-rational stance. You know, let's keep our feelings out of this. These conversations don't just involve feelings. They're at their very core about our feelings. And you're not being reasonable if you don't recognize how emotion-laden every high-stakes conversation is. WAIT, it's not just an act of the will, however. There's this move inward. This is the practice. This move inward to observe what is happening in you. You know, where is this energy coming from? This defensiveness. Where's that coming from? See, when you wait, you're giving yourself space to pay attention to your emotions. Now, where's this energy coming from? Emotions are energy. Emotion. They're driving you. Emotions are signals. And when you feel that energy, when you feel that signal inside you, your healthiest move is not outward. It's not defending what you believe. That's not going to help you. But inward, letting yourself feel, realizing that I'm having a feeling. In the middle of the conversation, to take a beat, to pause, to become aware and in touch with your own emotions. See, your feelings are there. We've already said high-stakes conversations, they're not just there, but they're actually running the show. All we're doing is slowing down enough to pay attention to those emotions so they're not blindly controlling us. We're owning them as opposed to what we naturally do, which is either enthroning them, that's letting them dictate what we do. We either enthrone or we deny, suppress, push down. But instead of denying or enthroning, we can WAIT. Why am I talking? Your emotions, one writer put it, are signals to your conscious brain that something is going on that requires your attention and action. That's all they are. Your conscious brain, if you choose to use it, gets to decide how you will respond. Okay? Don't enthrone. Don't suppress. You're just owning your emotions. Observe, welcome, name. Say right in the middle. Right, you're having a conversation. Right in the middle, instead of opening your mouth, wait. Don't enthrone. Don't stuff. Recognize. Recognize your emotions. Now, if this sounds simple, what I just said, then you've probably never done it. Everyone's talking about emotional intelligence these days, like it's so evident, but this is so challenging because what I'm really talking about is taking responsibility for your own emotions. Here's how the authors of another important book on this topic, Crucial Conversations, put it. They write, "Emotions are not foisted upon you by others. You make you mad. And only you create your emotions." Wow, that is just a line from a book, but that is incredibly offensive to us in our age of grievance. We just make it a habit to blame our emotions on others outside of us. Instead, I'm just saying WAIT. Why am I talking? Just to pause. Where's this energy coming from? Because these emotions, my emotions, they are telling me something about what's going on in me. So you're not going to get to the heart of this conflict without reckoning with what's happening in your own heart. That's actually not about the person in front of you. This is about you. The Psalms model for us what this might look like, to recognize our emotions and engage with them. And the Psalms engage with them in God's presence. But here's the key. If we wait, then in the moment, we can turn to Jesus as the third person in every conversation. We can turn to Jesus before we turn against the person in front of us. Turn to Jesus first. See, recognize your emotions as a flashing signal. Why am I talking? Turn to Jesus. Stop talking. When the psalmist wrote, this is Psalm 141, verse 3, set a guard over my mouth. That is not just saying a behavioral gag. It's saying every conflict is an invitation. Before you say anything, why am I talking? Take that energy as a prod to look inward. Something is happening in your heart. Pay attention. Again, sounds easy to pay attention to your emotions or engage your emotions, but for me, it's been like speaking Chinese. The concept is simple to understand, but to become even the least bit fluent takes months, even years of practice. Yes, this other person is maddeningly inconsistent, but guess what? So am I. And yet the Lord does not treat us as our sins deserve. So maybe right now in this conflict, I can, instead of reacting, release what I deserve, and instead I can WAIT. I can learn to move beyond what's happening in the moment, take a beat, and take ownership of my own emotional processes. I'm not getting enmeshed, to use the technical term. I'm just staying aware of my own thoughts, my own feelings, and I'm turning to Jesus in the middle of a difficult conversation. Okay? So you're having a conflict or a fight with someone very important to you. And instead of doing what we normally do, or reacting or making our case or trying to sort out, you know, what happened, instead, WAIT. Why am I talking? You take this, where is this energy coming from? And you use it as a prod to listen to your own heart in God's presence. Ken has told me that when you wait, you may discover that what you had initially believed was going to be a confrontation. You know, I'm going to tell you, turns out to be a confession. See, instead of attacking them, which is what you felt like doing because you waited, that pause often leads to leading with your own confession, because you're going to start with your own responsibility. See, even when you're convinced and your anger is righteous, Ken says, especially then, wait. Paul Tripp put it, when sinful people are sinned against, we tend to react sinfully. P.M. Melody called this offending from the victim position, that when we feel like a victim, it's easy to slip into becoming the offender. You hurt me so much that I get to react with impunity because of the way you hurt me. This is everywhere in our society today, selective outrage. But you know what's not everywhere? The wisdom of Jesus. The wisdom of Jesus is quick to listen, slow to speak. WAIT. Use that energy as a prod. What's this emotion telling me? That's a second rope to practice in the sunshine, so we can reach for it in the storm. Is get the log out of your own eye first. Many of you recognize that from Jesus. This is from the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus says, "This is Matthew 7. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own? How can you say to your brother, 'Let me take that speck out of your own eye,' when there is a log in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly. Then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye." Many of you, most of you have read Ken's book, The Peacemaker, which contains what Ken calls the four G's of peacemaking. And they're all important. But the most important G is this one: get the log out of your own eye first. Anytime you feel compelled to make a judgment about another before you dare to confront, get the log out of your own eye first. Jesus' wisdom is better than our normal course for at least four reasons. First, our keen observation is most likely a projection. You know, most scholars see in Jesus' word picture a profound psychological truth that came to be known as projection. A splinter is a much smaller part of a log. In other words, I recognize this splinter in your life only because I have a log in my own. What bothers me about you is actually one of my own biggest problems. So C.S. Lewis once said, "What bothers us the most about others is often what's most true about ourselves." The recovery community captures this wisdom in in their mantra, "Keep your own side of the street clean." See, when you see the garbage piled up high and deep on their side of the street, take that as a nudge to pay attention to your own garbage. No matter how upset you feel about their garbage, it's theirs. Your broom cannot reach their side of the street. So use your broom on your own stuff. You know, this is your keen observation has as much to do about you as it does about them. Second, getting the log out of your own eye helps the medicine go down if you ever dare to give it to someone else. I mean, think about Jesus' word picture. He says, if you have a speck in your eye, it takes tremendous amount of trust, doesn't it, to sit still enough to ever allow anyone to do surgery on such a sensitive part of your body as your eye. See, Jesus says, first get the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to help your brother. Let me put that in practical terms. Any feedback that you have is likely to be received only if it comes from a posture of felt empathy, as in, I'm only able to see this in you because I have been guilty of it myself in so many deeper ways. See, would you sit still and keep your eye open for one who came barreling in? Leslie, get that splinter out of here! No, but if they came with tweezers saying, I know this hurts because I've had the same surgery, and I promise I'll be so gentle, well, you might feel that they might be able to help you, and maybe you'd be willing to let them help because they can sympathize. Get the log out of your own eye. Third, Jesus' order of surgery greatly reduces the frequency of our conflicts and the intensity of our conflicts. Let me say this as plainly as I can. When I first began to reckon with the implications of what Jesus was saying in Matthew 7, I said to Ken, wow, if I took what Jesus was saying here, if I took his words to heart, if I took him seriously, I would probably never confront anyone again. I'd feel so convicted by my own hypocrisy. And Ken, I remember, you know, Ken just looked at me waiting for the penny to drop. Because isn't that what Jesus says? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to help your brother. See, in the midst of a very real conflict, amidst a protracted conflict, a mentor once said to me, Rankin, you're so upset over things or people are saying to you that you feel are untrue, why don't instead you call to mind those things that they don't know about you that are true, that are worse? See, that was his very kind way of saying that my offense was blinding me. It was blinding me. You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye. My defensiveness was signaling, wow, this is really about me. And fourth, and maybe most importantly, Jesus' adage assures us that we are not seeing clearly. Can't say this clearly enough. We are not seeing clearly. According to Jesus, when we dare to approach anyone about helping them see, we should start by assuming that we ourselves do not see. I have a friend who's a widely respected counselor on the West Coast. He's logged over 60,000 professional hours. I heard him ask once, in all of his decades of helping couples in conflict, how many times each side was convinced they saw the situation and the other party in the situation clearly. He said, every time without exception. Close quote. No one comes in assuming they are blind about themselves. We are all self-deceived, and by definition, we can't see when we are self-deceived. In Adam Grant's new book, Think Again, he says the dawning awareness of the prevalence of bias in our thinking is the new frontier in social science. That we are not the rational actors that we believe ourselves to be. That we are prone to cognitive biases. And our primary bias is our assumption that we are not biased, that we see clearly, that we are objective observers. What's the alternative? Listen to Jesus. When you are tempted to judge, instead begin by assuming that the splinter that you may see in them, you have a log in your own eye. And if you have a log in your eye, what does that do? That obstructs your vision. Get the log out of your own eye first. Then, Jesus says, you can see clearly. Thomas Merton tells a story about one of the desert fathers. A brother happened to commit a fault, and the elders assembled and sent for Abba Moses to join them. He, however, did not want to come. The priest sent him a message saying, come, the community of the brethren is waiting for you. So he arose and started off, and taking with him a very old basket full of holes, he filled it with sand and carried it behind him. The elders came out to meet him and said, what is this, Father? The elder replied, my sins are running out behind me, and I do not see them. And today, I come to judge the sins of another? Then hearing this, they said nothing to the brother, and they all pardoned him. See, that's a story from the ancient church of Matthew 7 in action. Just it means we're very slow and cautious and merciful if we ever dare to try to help another man see. So wait. Get the log out of your own eye first. Our third rope we can practice, pulling in the sunshine so we're not swept up in the storm of everyday conflict, is, and this is one of the most important things I've learned from Ken, strive to make a charitable judgment. Strive to make a charitable judgment. Particularly in a conflict, what is a charitable judgment? Brené Brown refers to this as learning to say, what if they're doing the best they can? Now, when I first heard Ken say this, I was irate. What do you mean? Of course they're not doing the best they can. They don't deserve a charitable judgment. When our expectations are unmet, when our feelings are hurt, here's what usually happens. We don't make a charitable judgment. We defend ourselves. Especially the best of us, we are not charitable. And here's a proof of that. When we make mistakes, what do we tend to do? We tend to explain our behavior in light of our complexity, our circumstances. We view ourselves in a three-dimensional context. I was tired. I was hungry. We like to point to our good intentions. I was only trying to help. See, in our eyes, we are complex and we are reasonable. But when it comes to others, we don't see them in three-dimensional complexity. We draw them in two-dimensional figures, a caricature. You know how a caricature works. You take something that has some truth to it, but then you draw it all out of proportion until it becomes a defining characteristic. And that's what we do. We make a sweeping judgment about how this action or that word reflects upon this person's entire
character. We do this all the time. We do this so often that it has a name, the fundamental attribution error. The fundamental attribution error. We see ourselves with complexity, and we sum up others and make judgments about their character, judging them uncharitably. And man, when I learned about this, it was so convicting because I realized, wow, this is how I spend pretty much every day of my life. Today, when I notice myself being instinctually critical and summing up, and it's a daily temptation, I catch myself and instead say, here's an opportunity to make a charitable judgment, strive to make a charitable judgment. Now, when Ken was just trying to teach me this, I have to confess, I just saw it as an example of his off-the-charts optimism, and it struck me as naive. But I've come to see Ken's counsel as a very real way to embody mercy and compassion in our everyday relationships. Those are big words, mercy and compassion. You know what, you want to know what they look like in everyday relationships? They look like striving to make a charitable judgment. It's replacing a critical spirit with one of patience and curiosity. What's going on? What's going on? Where's the pain? What's underneath the iceberg? My friend Orson Bean tells a story of being on a subway in New York City one day, and there was a young father sitting across from him who was completely zoned out. His three kids were running all over the subway car, fighting with each other, yelling, disrupting the other passengers. And Orson said he was sitting there thinking, don't you even see your kids? What a terrible dad. So he was judging. He was making assumptions. What's wrong with you? Moments later, the young man lifted his head and his eyes met Orson's, and he finally spoke. We're just coming back from the hospital. My wife is not going to make it. We're just told she's not going to make it. Orson said, that's an extraordinary story, but what's universal is the person sitting across from you who may have just snapped at you or acted so unreasonably. That person is fighting a hard battle. You know, you can be sure of that because everyone is fighting a hard battle. And they're trying to manage that pain, most likely in some very unhealthy way that they've been practicing since they were kids. So you don't know, but you can be sure of this. That person who is acting out, they are carrying a very deep pain. Most likely a pain they've not had any help to work through. Say, what if they're doing the best they can? Don't they get to be a human being? Don't they get to be a complex human being filled with contradictions? See, making a charitable assumption allows them, gives them permission to be a human being. I've learned a secret that life is so much more enjoyable when I make the choice to make a charitable judgment. That's not who they want to be, or that's just their pain speaking, or they get to be a human being. See, how might we become people who habitually make charitable judgments? Only by spending a great deal of time bearing our weaknesses in God's presence and receiving His mercy. See, we don't see clearly. Jesus is the only one who sees all sides clearly, and yet Jesus still moves toward all of us with mercy and compassion. They know not what they do. See, making a charitable judgment, this is not sentimentality. It is an embodiment of mercy and compassion in everyday conflict. Okay, wait, get the log out of your own eye first, make a charitable judgment. Now, if you're paying attention, you've noticed you haven't even opened your mouth yet. You haven't even opened your mouth yet. So here's a fourth principle. Finally, we get to talk. The fourth principle, seek first to understand. Seek first to understand and only then to be understood. See, in everyday conflicts, when we finally speak, our first step is most always a misstep, because we start by trying to make sure the other party understands our position. We want to defend ourselves. But remember, the conflict is almost never about the what happened. The what happened. That's a dead-end street. Arguing your position, playing lawyer or counselor. You say, don't facts matter? Well, have you ever heard the old adage, you never win a fight with your spouse? Because even if you win, you lose something more valuable. So you think that winning this argument is going to make you feel better. But if you are really making a wise investment in your happiness, then you'd seek first to understand so they'd feel understood. The Bible says, let each of you look not only to his own interests, but in humility consider others more significant than yourselves. A practical way to do this is make this one of your new favorite phrases that you use in every crucial conversation. Help me understand. Help me understand. The maxim, seek first to understand and not to be understood, is from St. Francis of Assisi. But just dream with me how our conflicts would be dramatically changed if we just adopted this one posture, replacing our desire to justify ourselves and defend ourselves, assuming that we see clearly what's going on, choosing not to make a judgment, to suspend judgment about the other's motives, and instead learning to say, help me understand. See, only by asking questions can you gain clarity about the other person, where they're coming from. And asking questions helps the person in front of you feel heard, feel cared for, feel understood. See, if they if they help me understand, if they finally speak, this is the magic moment. You resist the moment to solve, you resist the temptation to fix, which is what a lot of us men do with our wives. They tell us what's wrong, and then we try to tell them why they shouldn't feel this way. Try to talk them out of their feelings. Instead, seek first to understand can look like validating their feelings. Boy, that sounds really hard. That communicates that you're listening. Listening is caring. Instead of assuming intent, help me understand. Give an example. In our meeting today, I interpreted your body language as saying that you weren't interested in what I had to say. The story I was telling myself was, he doesn't appreciate me. And see, I'm taking responsibility for my feelings. I'm using an I statement. I felt frustrated, or I felt hurt, as opposed to you really frustrated me or you really hurt me. And see, you waited. You looked inward. And imagine how differently things would play out if you heard back, I'm so sorry I was not more attuned to how I was coming across. I got a call this morning from the school, and boy, I've been worried about my kids all day. See, seeking first to understand sounds great in theory, but in practice, it's incredibly hard when we feel attacked. So here's a visual image that my counselor, Tom, taught me. When you sense that someone is coming at you aggressively, especially when you think it's not fair, instead of responding in kind and matching their intensity, that's only going to pour fuel on the fire, that's only going to escalate. He said, visualize receiving all that energy, but then placing it to the side, taking note of your emotions. Emotions are signals. You're going to sort those out with the Lord. But right now, you can stay present, you know, with them and for them. Help me understand. It's incredibly counterintuitive, because by nature, we're going to tend to fight or flight. You know, fight back or flight, run away, a shutdown or freeze. It requires so much more courage to stay present, to listen. Richard Rohr points out that listening well is a vulnerable position. It's a vulnerable position. You know, we're not protecting ourselves, and we don't have to insist on being understood because we believe the gospel, and the gospel frees us from the tyranny of needing to be understood. The gospel frees us from needing the other person to understand us as a condition for listening to them. No, we already have the security that we are fully known by Christ and deeply understood by God, so we can be present. Because that person in front of us, they just want to feel heard. They want to feel heard and understood. Help me understand. Okay? Listening and seeking to understand rather than trying to win and be right. That's the only way that you're going to get what you really... What's the win here? What do you really want here? If it's a relationship of trust and intimacy, the way to do it, seek to understand first before you try to get them to understand you. And that brings us to the fifth rope. And this is a big one for churchgoers to learn. Fifth, move toward the mess. Move toward the mess. These first four practices have to do with restraint, don't we? What we don't do. Don't react, don't speak, get the log out of your own eye first. But this one, this last one has to do with what takes more courage, and that is not avoiding the conflict, but moving toward the mess. See, we'd rather be nice. And we baptize our passivity and call it humility, but more often it's just cowardice. We settle for a false peace. Jesus reminds us that trying to sweep up the house without working through the things ends up making things seven times worse in the long run. See Luke 11, verse 24. But if you're anything like me, we're scared of conflict for many reasons. We're scared of our big emotions, particularly anger. If I let myself feel these big feelings, what will happen? So we move away. We try and avoid. One of the most prevalent ways we avoid moving towards the mess in churches is triangulation. Triangulation is talking about someone not present to a third party in order to induce a negative perception about that person without that person being present to defend themselves. This happens all the time. We're forming a tribe, a herd of right-thinking people who now know the real truth about what really happened. Last week, my 12-year-old asked my 9-year-old, "Who is the worst teacher at your school?" And my little boy said, "I'm not going to answer that question." Now, I have a million stories of parental failures, but I have to tell you, at that moment, I exulted. Because my little 9-year-old was refusing to participate in triangulation. That same 9-year-old later in the congregation was asked why another kid had stopped coming to school. And he said, "That's not my story to tell. That's not my story to tell." Now, some of you are thinking maybe your 9-year-old should be giving this talk. Maybe so. But those are real-time examples of refusing to participate in triangulation, because even a 9-year-old can see that no matter how dressed up it is, it's a form of gossip. But you know what gossip is? It's just a byproduct of avoiding conflict. It's of not moving towards the mess. We'd rather gossip. See, so many church splits could have been avoided had we moved toward the mess, face to face with all concerned parties at the table together. Why am I talking? Get the log out of your own eye first. Seek first to understand, not to be understood, making a charitable judgment, okay? as opposed to what we often do in church conflicts, and that's what Ken calls a drive-by shooting. You know what a drive-by shooting is? That's an email. It's an email from one leader to another. Has that ever worked for you? Has anyone ever said, "You know, thank you for that long email, that really changed my mind"? In interpersonal conflicts, we need to move toward one another, face to face in the mess. I'm going to give you a tool for moving towards the mess. And I promise you, if you learn this tool and practice it, it can transform how you navigate everyday conflict, because it allows you to move towards the mess. And it's a three-step pattern. First, you say, here's my recollection of events. You start by acknowledging your memory, because perhaps you've learned that memory doesn't work the way we think it does, that our memories are faulty, our memories are biased. They are not objective. They are subject to change. We see what we want to see and hear what we want to hear. So when you say, here's my recollection, it's a way of saying it's not the whole truth, but it's my perspective. Here's my recollection of what happened. Okay, there's a humility in that statement. Here's my recollection. Second, and here's the story I was telling myself. Here's the story that I made up. You say, don't facts matter? Of course facts matter, but all facts are interpreted. And the way we make sense of the fact is that we tell stories to ourselves. Which stories? Our stories, the stories that we made up. You're doing it right now as I'm speaking. It's how you're making sense of what I'm saying. You're framing this in your mind's eye, because that's part of what we do as human beings. We create narratives on the fly. We create stories. So here's my recollection of what happened, and here's the story I made up. Here's the story I was telling myself about what happened. And then third, and this is, here's the gold, third, and here's the feelings that I had attached to that story. See, my feelings, for which I'm responsible, stemming from my story that I made up based on my recollection of events. Here's how the authors of Crucial Conversation put it. Emotions are not foisted upon you by others. You and you alone create your emotions. Wow. You need to pause this podcast or tape right there and listen to that again, because that's just a line. But if you took it to heart, it would completely change how you engaged in everyday conflict. Completely change. Those are my emotions. You and you only create your emotions. See, if you and the person in front of you had this agreed upon work, here's how we're going to work through conflict. We're going to, it's a three-step process. Number one, here's my recollection of what happened. Number two, here's the story I made up about that. And number three, here was the feelings attached to my story. Wow, that would completely change the whole footing and the whole ground of how you work through conflicts. So much less, it diffuses everything, so much less accusatory. Philip Yancey once asked, why can't the church be more like the recovery community? See, why is it recovery communities look more like the church, mixed age, mixed race, rich and poor, than most churches ever do? Because they have agreed upon foundational steps that in practice we find hard to admit to ourselves. I'm a mess. I can't fix myself. I need help. Only God can help me. I think I'll let Him. See, churches are notorious for avoiding conflict. We need to recognize our temptation to hold on to offense for what it is. One writer called it, it's the bait of Satan. He's saying holding on to offense divides more churches and more Christians than any other scheme of the devil. I mean, Jesus tells us how to handle conflict. Go directly to your brother. It's hard to stab someone in the chest when you're looking at them in the eye, Brené Brown adds. That person is not going to listen to you until they feel felt, Dan Brown adds. Excuse me, Dan Siegel. People have to feel understood before they will care what you have to say. That's where we said, earlier, conflict is the bridge to intimacy. This is how trust gets established. You're working through it in a context of vulnerable community. That's why I was talking about the recovery community. You're working through it together. I can't fix myself. I need help. Here's my recollection of events. Here's my story. Here's the feelings I had attached to that. See, when you can work through conflict openly, in vulnerability, that's what establishes trust between the two of you. So there it is, Sandy's greatest hits. Wait, get the log out, make a charitable judgment, seek to understand, and move towards the mess. Now, I've given you a lot this morning. And, you know, of course, that's not the only way, but that's, you know, you could say a biblical-based way to work through conflict. Ken once famously put it, every conflict is an opportunity to glorify God. We started by lamenting that the church is the last place that we often may see or experience deep relational healing. And I've suggested that we don't know how to manage everyday conflict. And this morning I've added that Ken's gift is really just bringing out these biblical tools. Wait, get the log out of your own eye, make a charitable judgment, seek first to understand, move towards the mess. And life is so much more enjoyable. You know, any one of these, not just all five of them, but even if we internalized one of these and how we navigate everyday conflict, it would change everything. Move towards the mess. Where's that in the Bible? Well, that's the whole story of the Bible, isn't it? Remember in Genesis, what's the first thing the Lord says to Adam and Eve after they make a mess of paradise? What's the first thing He says? Where are you? The Lord God called out in the Garden of Eden. See, where are you? God came out. He moved towards the mess. And we kept running away from Him. That's really the story of the Bible until God became one of us. And what did we do with God when He came upon the earth? And yet, even still, He kept moving towards us all the way to the cross. See, I know in the heart of conflict, you can't remember. We won't remember these five practices. But again, anyone will help you. But even if you did practice all five, you say, wait a minute, the other person, they haven't read Ken Sandy. I'm owning my emotions, but they're still blaming me. I'm getting the log out of my eye, but they're using that log to bash me over the head. They're not making a charitable judgment. They're attacking me. they're certainly not seeking to understand me, but they're making assumptions about me. So what do you do then? Well, let's close here. The cross is not only our message, the cross is our method. See, the way of self-sacrifice, the way of crucified love, the way of dying of our need to be right. Isn't that how Jesus overcame the world? See, it's the gospel. It's the gospel that gives us the ground, the safe ground. You know, we are safe, we are secure, we are understood, we are known. So I don't have to hold on to this offense. I don't have to hold on to this anger. I don't have to hold you hostage. The way of anger is only going to ratchet up the animosity. The goal is not to win. The goal is to sow peace. And you can know, no matter what, the way of the cross, the way of the cross is always the way forward in everyday conflict. See, didn't Jesus wait? He opened not His mouth. The only one who didn't have a beam in his eye, He climbed on the beam. Didn't He make a charitable judgment? Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. Didn't He set our interest above His own? And thank God He moved towards the mess, or else we'd all be lost. If those of us who say that we believe the gospel can start to practice gospel, speak gospel in everyday conflict, instead of being the only place that Ken said in 40 years he had not seen biblical peacemaking, instead, local churches can become hospitals of healing. Hospitals of healing. Because the gospel doesn't just give us the power, it tears down the dividing walls of hostility. Boy, and when church leaders climb our crosses, conflicts will not endure. Okay, that was a lot, but there it is in one mixtape, Sandy's Greatest Hits. Okay? Hope that helps you. Ken, I love you.